Hello, I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of January 24th, 2014. So as you know, this show is about how to not only get more money out of the choices you make in life, but more value. This week in How We Live Money, let's give ourselves some credit. Like it or not, credit has seeped into every nook and cranny of our lives, from getting a job to getting a date. A lot has changed since the days of our first diner's card, and much within the past couple of months.
You sign up for a credit card, you call to activate it. Often they're trying to sell you other products. You agree you're going to pay $10 a month. Months later, when you go to seek the protection, they say, oh, you didn't have it. You know, that's wrong. That's totally unfair. And we've been getting hundreds of millions of dollars back for consumers back in their pockets because they were mistreated in this way.
There is little or no correlation between having a problem with credit and whether or not you can get out and do a job. So basically what this is about basic fairness.
So that was Richard Cordray. He's the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He appeared on The Daily Show earlier this month to talk about new credit card regulation that the Bureau is putting into effect to protect consumers. This all adds to the rules of the CARD Act of 2009. He was followed by Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's put forth a bill to stop employers from using credit checks as a filter for job applicants. So today for you, we've got credit, and more credit. Welcome to our special edition of Marketplace Money, our State of the Credit Union. Now, we know our credit history is, for the most part, made up of what debts we have, how we manage these bills. But now, some reporting agencies are using our social media information, that's Facebook and Twitter, to add to our credit reports. Joining us now to talk about this madness is credit expert John Oltzheimer. He's the president of the Oltzheimer Group. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Carmen.
John, I call this madness because it just seems over the top. It's very, very personal. What are they trying to find out? How does what we post on Facebook or on Twitter, how does that correlate to our creditworthiness?
You know, it's interesting. It's less about what you're saying and more about who you're saying it to than anything else. It's the whole mantra that birds of a feather will tend to flock together. And if you tend to connect with people who are high risk or higher risk borrowers, then the perception is that you are as well. And that's really where the issue lies.
But let's say that you have family or you have friends that are having some credit trouble, that this actually can rub off on you. I have to ask you, John, is this actually legal?
That remains to be seen. And whether or not it's legal really is up to how it is perceived in the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. And here's how it shakes out. It has to be built using science, and B, it has to actually work, and you have to be able to prove that it works. And so if you're going to use anything out of the social media world, whether it's who your Facebook friends are, how often you tweet, the things like that, what you're linking to, it has to be predictive of risk for a lender to be able to use it in a credit scoring system. And that's what the law says.
Well, and there's a big money question here, right? Because the crack I was going to make about Zuckerberg and Facebook is like, well, if it makes some money, then, you know, because this credit reports and credit scoring and all stuff, this is really a big business.
It's a huge business, but here is the massive, massive problem that companies like Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest and all the other social media sites are going to have to deal with. Right now, none of those companies are what's referred to as a consumer reporting agency. The Fair Credit Reporting Act has a very clear definition of what is a consumer reporting agency. The minute any of these social media sites decide to monetize their information for the purposes of allowing lenders and credit reporting agencies to assess the risk of any company doing business with any particular consumer, then they also become a consumer reporting agency. And I'm not sure Facebook, Twitter, or any of the other social media outlets really understand what it means to be a consumer reporting agency, because it is expensive and the obligations that are thrust upon you by the Fair Credit Reporting Act are extremely onerous. Oh, and by the way, you're going to be in the crosshairs for any number of federal Fair Credit Reporting Act lawsuits if consumers don't get jobs, if they get denied credit, if they get adverse interest rates because of the information that you're housing.
How do we know that we're being monitored? Do we know? And should we be concerned about this?
You should assume you're being monitored, but I'm not sure that people actually get that. I have friends that have thousands of friends on Facebook. And I know that they don't have thousands of friends in the real world. And because of the ever-expanding use of this information outside of its original intent, which was just simply to communicate with people, they may now regret doing what they've done because now they're going to start learning, oh, wait a minute, this information is being used to collect debts. This information might actually be used to assess whether or not I can get a loan and at what interest rate. I'm not so sure I actually want to be on here anymore. And it's not as easy as just clicking a button and everything disappears. That just doesn't happen.
What should people do going forward or consider on social media?
The first thing I would suggest is not to go into paralysis. There's nothing wrong with using social media outlets. It's fun. It makes our lives more efficient and more enjoyable, and there's nothing wrong with it. I would just be very careful that if you're not willing to tell everybody something, then don't post it on Facebook or don't post it on Twitter. Don't tweet about it. Don't blog about it because everybody can see it.
Oh, John Altsheimer, always opening our eyes. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm very glad to have been here. Thanks for having me.
Your credit, or lack thereof, now determines not only if and how you borrow money, but if an employer will hire you. So if not having credit may mean not getting a job, can you afford to not use credit at all? Here to discuss is Michelle Singletary. She's a Washington Post columnist and the author of the 21-Day Financial Fast. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
So glad to have you because, you know, we've had this conversation. You and I have been doing this for a long time. And we've talked together, even on panels together, about credit and the use of it. And now, unlike when we started out, credit is being used all over your life. How do you feel this changes some of the advice?
You know, I'm not sure it changes it a great deal. There are people who can live without credit, but they tend to be much more financially secure. They've already established credit at some point, and now they don't want to use it anymore. And so they've already laid that groundwork for them. And I applaud them. I mean, I use a credit card, but I also know that studies show when you use credit, you spend more than when you use cash. And you can go off the grid if you want to.
But if you go off the grid, let's say, and you're looking for a job, and now, you know, that employer is more and more, and it's just growing because, you know, the credit reporting and scoring industry is a business after all. So there's a lot of room for it to grow and for them to say, hey, employers, you're looking to sort people out because there's still only one job for every three applicants. Here's a way to sort people through the system. So is there danger in not being a part of the system in a responsible way?
Well, what employers are looking for is derogatory information. So if you know you don't have a credit score or it's dropped because you're not using credit, you just let the employer know, listen, there's nothing going on. I just decided that I want to use cash. What they're looking for is to see if people have low credit scores or who have misused credit. What you have to say, you got to let them know up front. Listen, I don't want to do this credit thing. I've decided consciously not to do that. I don't have any debt, and let them know ahead of time. It's those folks who have low credit scores, 500s, you know, 400s, who got, you know, bankruptcy, things like that. That's what many employees are looking for. And particularly if you've got a government job and you're looking for security clearance, again, just let the investigator know this is what's going on. And that should not hurt you. It's the negative stuff that will hurt you as opposed to the absence of information.
Well, I have to tell you, though, Michelle, I've spoken to some big corporations or folks who work for them, particularly in human resources, who will not go on record, let me just say, but who say that they use a computer system. They have a cutoff number for credit scores, and you won't even get to talk to them. You won't even get in the door to be able to say, here's why my credit's bad. I've been out of work for a long time. So there's no chance to explain yourself. So how can folks, or do you feel that that's something that if you have trouble with credit, you have to find just other ways to get through?
There are many reasons why people have low credit scores right now. They lost their home because they were laid off. Does that make them not a good employee? So I wouldn't put that on the person. Now, again, if that is the situation and you're applying for a job and there's some space somewhere on the application or a phone call or email to let them know, hey, this is what's going on, just so you know, that should help them, letting them know ahead of time.
Michelle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Michelle Singletary is the Personal Finance Washington Post columnist and author of the 21-Day Financial Fast. If you have a question or a comment about living off the credit grid, head over to marketplacemoney.org. We'd love to hear from you. So the requirements of this club are simple. You'll need to be at least in your 30s and have squeaky, clean credit. It's the 800 Club, folks with the highest FICO scores. And so we wondered, who are these elite club members?
That would be me. My name is Frederick. I live in San Diego, California, and I'm 58 years old. I grew up in a big family. There were 8 children and 2 parents. I give my mom the credit for teaching financial responsibility. She started us off with piggy banks and savings accounts. She told us to prioritize and to know what things cost. And not in the sense of dollars and cents, but if you buy this, you're not going to have money to buy that. The very first purchase that I ever made that I had to borrow money to do it was a mobile home. My motivation was to get into a home of my own and get it paid for. When I joined the Navy and left home, I was in a bunch of Navy friends, and I would see how some of their immediate gratification things kind of backfired on them. And I had heard that everybody grows from mistakes. The trick is to get somebody else to make the mistakes. And all of my friends were doing that for me. My name is Frederick, and my credit score is 830.
Coming up, get out those training wheels. It's credit for your teenagers.
You are having them use a credit card while they're still under your roof, or you still have some influence over them, can talk about the importance of, you know, paying off the balance in full every single month, no matter what.
More on the story of your life on credit. Next on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Carmen Wong-Ulrich. So we asked you to send us your credit questions. Boy, did you ever. So we're going to answer some specific questions right now. And here to superpower our credit answer team is Liz Weston. She's a personal finance columnist and author of The 10 Commandments of Money, How to Survive and Thrive in the New Economy. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Carmen.
Thank you so much for joining us, Liz. You know, credit, it's one of those topics I feel in personal finance that actually, you know, it's changing year after year. And with the CARD Act, you know, passing and all of that, it seems like a really lively business. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we used to joke that there's only 14 real stories in personal finance, and you just keep putting new anecdotes on the top. But with credit, it actually does change. You know, we had incredible loosening of credit in the 90s and through the beginning of the century. And then we had the crash of the financial, you know, crisis and the mortgage mess and all that. And now we're trying to kind of find our way through the aftermath of all that. And as you said, that Credit Card Reform Act made a big difference for a lot of people. You know, it took away a lot of the fees that were causing them problems, but it also put new responsibilities both on issuers and on people. For instance, it's a bit harder to get a card in college than it used to be. That's one of the things that really changed.
Well, funny you should mention that one, because it's a great segue to our first caller. We got a voicemail from a listener in the Twin Cities.
Hi, my name is Michael, calling from St. Paul, Minnesota, and I just wanted help trying to settle a very slight dispute between my wife and I. Our daughter's a first-year student at University of Chicago, is very hardworking and very responsible. I think our daughter should apply for a credit card to start building her credit history. And my wife disagreed when this came up and thinks that maybe she should wait, let that be an after college thing to do. As it stands, she doesn't even know we're having an argument about this. She's never needed a credit card up to this point. I'm not sure if she believes she needs one or not. I think she should to help build her history that way. I think I was a little bit slower building credit and wish I had earlier. So my question is it a good idea for our daughter to get a credit card, start responsibly using it, paying it off, I hope?
Well, funny enough, Liz, you know, that's part of the CARD Act, right? That this change that basically if you're a full-time college student, you can't prove income, that you end up not being able to get your own credit card. So where do you stand on this one?
Well, in this case, she would probably need a cosigner if she didn't have an income. And we're assuming that she doesn't have like a part-time job or whatever. But you're right that the requirement that, you know, students be able to show that they can pay off whatever debt they have is a barrier for some to get a credit card. So they need to turn to a parent. Now, I will say it is important to build credit over time. And the daughter here is going to need at some point to get an apartment on her own. Landlords typically check your credit. Insurance, auto insurance tends to be priced by your credit history. There's a lot of ways that credit becomes important. And then when she wants a mortgage someday. So it is a good idea to build credit history. And I would argue don't wait until she gets out of college, because although it's a little more difficult now than it used to be to get a credit card, it's still going to be easier to get one in college than afterward. And if you don't have kids that are quite to college age yet, I might even say you might want to start them with a credit card before they even graduate high school. And this would have been anathema a few years ago. But the idea is that you are kind of putting training wheels on a credit card. You are having them use a credit card while they're still under your roof, or you still have some influence over them, can talk about the importance of, you know, paying off the balance in full every single month, no matter what. Don't charge more than you can afford to pay off. Those are important lessons to learn, and you have a little more control when they're still under your roof.
Oh, Liz, I'm over here. My arms are going up. I'm saying amen. Amen to you. Amen. Hallelujah. Because let me tell you, I'm getting all church here, because I was one of those kids in college that, you know, before when you used to be able to get a card very easily in college. And I started so that when I graduated from college and needed an apartment, I had credit card debt that was well managed and a student loan, and I was able to get that apartment. And I see so many 20-somethings right now who have no credit history. They cannot even get a credit card, even if they have a full-time job.
Yeah.
So it's so, I just echo your sentiment that it's actually so important to start as soon as you can. And to your point about the training wheels, I feel like it's one of those, don't be afraid, because you need to teach them and communicate with them. And also, you're a co-signer, so keep that maximum allowed to be charged very low. Keep
yes.
It really low on that card so that they don't go crazy with pizza and God knows what else. But it's so important to start these conversations early and have training wheels.
Yeah, and it's not something that has to be a big deal for parents. They can add a kid as an authorized user to a credit card. You don't even need to have the kid have access to the card. That alone will help them build credit over time. But at some point, you do want to, you know, start handing over the reins and start having those discussions. And again, the most important thing, make sure they understand that a credit card's a convenience. You don't want to carry any debt on it. Make sure you can pay it off in full every month.
Absolutely. And then you can build that history. And now we're joined by Megan from Cary, North Carolina. Megan, hello. You have a question. Also another question tied to a young person.
Yes, thank you. I have two small children, and they have Social Security numbers, which is necessary to claim them as dependents on my federal taxes. But I'm concerned, and I'm interested in hearing what you would recommend for parents to make sure that their credit is not in any way compromised during this time period where they're not going to be active users of credit. And with identity theft risks out there, I just wonder what you would suggest for folks like me who want to make sure that when their kids are old enough and want to establish their own credit history, that they are not surprised and unpleasantly surprised to find somebody else has used their Social Security number.
Oh, wow.
Without
wow.
their knowing.
That's a big one, Megan, and it is a big concern. Of all you see in the news, of course, all the, you know, stealing the card information and identity theft, and it is a big issue. But Liz, you know, what do you think of this kind of the preemptive, you know, strike, you know, to put up a wall so this doesn't happen? Is that possible?
Well, here's the difficulty. In order to have a credit report, anything to monitor at the credit bureaus, you have to have some credit. So if your child has a credit account at a credit bureau, they're already a victim, okay? The problem is you get asked all these questions to verify your identity when you try to go in and look at your credit report. You won't know the answers if the child's already been a victim of identity theft. So do you see the problem here? We've got a situation where if there's no problem, there won't be any record, so it's kind of pointless to try to find it. If there is a record, then there is a problem, but you won't be able to get access to the record online or through credit monitoring. So what we tell parents is, first of all, you want to kind of gauge your risk. If there is most children who are victims of identity theft are victims because of a family member. It's like an ex that steals their credit information, or even the custodial parent, whatever. That tends to be the more common situation. But if you are still concerned about this, if you think your child is at high risk, then you have to go through these procedures that the bureau set up, and it can't be done online. You have to. The best way is to go to a site called idtheftcenter.org, and they can walk you through all the requirements that the bureaus have for you trying to see if your child has a credit report. It involves getting birth certificates and your ID and all this other stuff. You send it off, and hopefully the answer comes back. Nope, there's nothing there. You can't preemptively put on a credit freeze because, again, there's no credit information, hopefully, to look at. If the child has been a victim of identity theft, then that site can help walk you through what to do. And then at that point, you probably can put a freeze on the account.
Yeah, and Megan, I'll add to that. You know, you noted in your question that there's a couple of services that you would pay for this, that, you know, credit monitoring is a business, and it's a very big business. And it's kind of like, you know, selling security for your home as such. It helps them to kind of frame it that this is an incredibly dangerous thing and we're here to kind of protect you. But to Liz's point, there are some things that you can't necessarily protect until it happens, which is no fun, right, Liz?
Yes, no fun. Exactly.
That's no fun. But there are resources out there that you don't necessarily have to pay for. Megan, can I ask, has this ever happened to you? Have you ever been a victim?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Thus far.
She's knocking on lots of wood right
yes,
now.
Yes, yes.
As we all are. And it is, and so many folks have been in this situation, but, you know, there's a big difference between identity theft, which is tied to the Social Security numbers, and then kind of card theft. And the card theft is so much easier. So may we all just be blessed with that. But identity theft is an issue. So does that make you feel any better, Megan, in terms of, you know, what to do? Or is this something that you just feel strongly is bothering you?
No, and it's just, it was just, again, a preemptive strike just to make sure that I'm doing everything that I can so that in 18 years of time, we don't find out that something has been awry for a long time that we then need to make it, you know, correct. This is very useful information, though. It does actually make me feel a little bit better that it's not all that easy probably for someone to, unless they have access to the numbers, which we obviously protect very, very closely, that the risk is small anyway. And so we will just take, you know, look into what Liz recommends. Thank you.
Yeah. And Megan, you know, the odds are it's more likely they'll come after you, but they won't because you'll be paying attention.
There we go.
Just so you know. But Liz, I find this so interesting that we have these questions now that we're all parents are really caring about their kids' credit history and information. This is all very fascinating, but we'll be right back. Liz, stick around. Megan, thank you so much. We're going to be right back after this break.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, and we're back with Liz Weston. We're taking your questions. Joining us now is Yvette from South St. Paul, Minnesota. Yvette has a question about recovering from bankruptcy, because that is a good place to go in terms of coming up from the bottom, and she wants to get back on top. Yvette, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for taking my call and my question. Well, back in November of 2013, I finished my Chapter 13 bankruptcy. And then a few weeks later, I finished my divorce. So now this year, 2014, what I really want to do is start to reestablish myself, correct my credit, try to get back on some correct course of action. So the first thing I decided to do was look at opening a credit card. And I did get a credit card through Credit One Bank. It's a $35 annual fee, and I've got $600 line of credit at 17.9% interest. Now, everybody and their brother has an opinion on how I should recover from my bankruptcy. So some people are telling me, nope, forget the credit card. You shouldn't be paying for an annual fee. Your interest rate's too high. You know, you should just be stashing away, putting money away. Others are telling me you should look at getting a car loan instead and, you know, fixing your credit through a car loan. So I wanted to get your opinion. Is a credit card a good way to go to get started? Or do you see other courses of action that I can be taking to recover from the bankruptcy and the divorce?
Well, I tell you that, you know, Liz and I just had a little chuckle there when you said that everybody and their brother, because it is one of those situations where everybody has an opinion, but you always got to think about where they're coming from. So Liz, you know, recovering from bankruptcy, very serious thing, but there are multiple ways to go about it, right?
Absolutely. The idea that you can just handle your money responsibly and save up a lot of money and somehow overcome a bankruptcy is a little bit off mark, because the credit scoring formulas look at how you handle credit. If you don't have any credit accounts and you aren't building credit that way, your scores are not going to improve that fast. I mean, there will be some improvement because over time that bankruptcy is going to fade into the past and its effect will be less and less. But if you do want to build your scores up again, a credit card is a great way to do it as long as you use it responsibly. And you have a low credit limit. $600 is not that much. But you probably don't want to charge more than maybe $60, $100, $120 a month at the max. And you want to pay that in full every month. I think the mistake a lot of people make with credit cards is that they carry a balance thinking that will help them. It doesn't help you. It doesn't benefit you at all. So don't do it. And the other thing they do is they max out that card because they think, you know, $120, how much will that get me? Don't use it as a buying tool. Use it as a tool to build credit, which means small purchases, pay them off in full, use that card lightly but regularly. And maybe after 6 months, a year, you can look into getting a personal loan from a credit union, something like that. I'm not a big fan of going after an auto loan right away, right after a bankruptcy, because you are going to pay through the nose in interest. Mm. And I'm not sure that that's a good idea, particularly if you don't need a car anyway. But a personal loan, you can borrow a small amount, pay that back over time, not have an outrageous interest rate, and that too will build your credit. The idea of having both an auto loan and a credit card is that you want both types of credit. You want revolving credit and you want an installment loan if you want to rehabilitate your credit faster. So that's what your friends are talking about. They're a little bit off the mark, but you're actually doing the right thing as long as you don't carry a balance on that credit card. Because, yeah, 18% interest, that's a lot. But a $35 annual fee is not for a tool that's helping you recover from bankruptcy.
Okay, great.
Yeah, Yvette, and that's the thing. The folks who are saying to you, oh, you're paying an annual fee and you shouldn't and all that sort of stuff, those folks probably have good credit. Because part of the reason why you have an expensive card is because you don't have good credit.
Yeah.
So they're going to charge you more. But you don't have to pay the interest, just that fee. And in this case, that could be worthwhile to build your credit.
That's good to know. I'm on the right track.
So, Yvette, you mentioned that you filed bankruptcy due to a divorce. Those two things, by the way, tend to go together sometimes. How did that happen?
Well, it happened. I was married for 20 years, and we had everything together. All of our finances were together. And when it came time for the divorce, the easiest course of action was to do a bankruptcy to go along with it. So the bankruptcy had to take place so that the divorce could take place. And what I've learned, actually, from all this is that we should have never had everything together. Going forward, if there is another marriage, I think I've learned that I need to keep finances separate. And I guess, is that what you would recommend if that ever comes about again, that in marriage or in a committed relationship, finances should be separate?
Well, maybe not 100%, but Liz, this is a really big issue. We hear a lot about this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just wanted to back up a minute, because a lot of people don't realize when they go through a divorce that all their credit accounts should be separated before the divorce is final, because they say, oh, I've got this divorce decree that says my ex is supposed to pay these debts. creditors don't have to pay any attention to a divorce decree. You made your agreement with them prior to the divorce. So what I find is a lot of people, you know, are starting to rebuild their credit, and all of a sudden they get a late payment, a charge off, or whatever, because their ex is not paying some joint account the way he was supposed to or she was supposed to. So the best idea is to separate those accounts. That bankruptcy has to happen, probably doing it before the divorce is final might be the best idea. But as far as going forward, it depends on the couple. A lot of people feel much more comfortable with joint accounts, and that's just the way they do things. If you're going to buy a house together, you're going to have a joint mortgage. That's just the way that, you know, most people have to roll. Once people have been through a divorce, they tend to be a lot more sensitive to these issues. And there's nothing wrong with keeping your finances separate. Sure. Just I would check in with an attorney first to make sure that you're going about it the right way, because you don't want to have the situation again.
And Yvette, just to know, so, you know, Liz, a lot of folks don't realize, though, that when you get married, your credit histories and scores are not married.
Exactly.
Those are completely separate. And Yvette, that's like another reason why I'm a big fan of always keeping at least something in your own name, some form of credit, a credit card, a private loan, so you have access to something that's separate from who you're with, just in case, just in case. Yvette, does that help your question?
It definitely does. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for joining us, Yvette.
Thank you.
And thanks to you, Liz, for joining us as well. It's always a juicy topic.
It is indeed. Thanks, Carmen.
So do you have a credit question? Head over to the Ask Carmen section of MarketplaceMoney.org and send one my way. You could be on soon. Are you single and ready to mingle? Well, some dating sites are based on a whole new way to find your perfect match, your credit score.
Online dating is a $2 billion industry, so I'm not surprised that someone found right. that angle.
Relationship expert Andrea Sirtash explains how this angle may work or not. Coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. You know, about 18% of Americans have FICO scores of 800 and above. And some folks get there only after hitting rock bottom. Now, the credit score climb can be a steep one, but sometimes it's really well worth the price.
My name is Cindy Mahaffey. I live in Fishers, Indiana, and my credit score is 820. I'm in my late 50s, the oldest of seven children. My father worked multiple jobs to support our family. I grew up in subsidized housing. My mother was not so great with money, and it was difficult to see other kids at school have things that we couldn't have. In my early 20s, I, like most people, probably didn't realize how important my credit score was and had a very low credit score and had many financial problems because of that. I had overextended myself with a shiny red Camaro, and because the monthly payments were so high, I couldn't afford rent and had to move in with my great-grandmother. I was married in my mid-20s. My husband was a saver and I was a spender, and that caused a lot of problems because we got into credit card debt. I realized we were in trouble when my husband sat down with me and talked about the extent of our credit card debt. And he asked me the question, what do you want our money to do for us? And I'd never thought of it that way. I always looked at getting a paycheck as a race to spend it as quickly as possible, not even thinking about the future. Just that one question changed my entire life. We wanted a child. We wanted to educate that child. We wanted a home. We wanted money in the bank. It took at least 5 years paying that mountain of credit card debt was difficult. In our mid-30s is when things really started turning around. We were able to purchase our second home and had money in the bank and started on our other financial goals. And that's how we did it, one step at a time. It does give you great peace of mind and the freedom to make choices. And now we're enriching our lives. And in fact, we have a trip to Italy planned for later this year. And that would never have been possible had we not started with that one question that my husband asked. What do you want our money to do for us? Well, we're going to Italy.
Thanks, Cindy, and to all of you who responded to our query about your awesome credit scores. But do you have some tips on how you became a high credit achiever? Tweet us at LiveMoney with the hashtag 800PlusClub. So you may have heard a potential date ask you, what's your sign? But how about, what's your credit score? Joining us to talk about the interesting combo of dating and credit is Andrea Sirtash. She's the host of the Life Story Project on OWN and the author of several relationship books, including Cheat on Your Husband with Your Husband. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, so here's the crazy thing. There was a study Utah State University found that in the majority of marriages, 66% of marriages have major debt problems. Most marriages start with debt from either party or both. And now there are actually sites dedicated to matchmaking. Now, we know there's matchmaking sites for everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
Religion, line of work, all those things. Matching you on credit scores. Andrea, what? I mean, talk about love and money. This seems like a rabbit hole of trouble.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. Actually, online dating is a $2 billion industry, so I'm not surprised that someone found
right.
that angle. But absolutely, it's one of the top reasons we know that couples split up. So, of course, credit scores, it's really important to know going into a long-term partnership. Most people don't discuss it. Actually, I came across research done by Match.com, another dating site, that showed that close to 95% of people said money is really important in a relationship, and yet only half of those people admitted that they actually talk about it in their partnership while they're dating.
Well, it's still scary territory because I think, and tell me if I'm right here, but don't most people just don't want to talk about money still, even though we know it is such an issue? We're all like tiptoeing on eggshells around it.
Let me say this. During the first few months of dating, kind of everybody is lying.
And
they don't, you know.
Seriously?
Seriously, I know. Breaking news.
Right.
But they don't, it's not even in a manipulative way. We're showing our best selves. We're putting our best foot forward. So I totally understand how on a first date, you're not going to say that you're in debt or expose that. But once you're in a committed partnership, and once you start thinking of the future, it is amazing to me that it's still taboo, because you have to know if you're aligned on all kinds of values. Money is certainly one of those values.
A credit score is not necessarily truthful of who you are in and of itself, because it could be because you've been out of work, or which maybe that doesn't make you a very attractive dating candidate. But it's life or a medical issue or such. So how much in dating should you be paying attention to something so specific?
I think, you know, the big thing daters must do in general is to read actions, not words. So, you know, you have to look at how the person is spending, how the person is acting, what the relationship is with money. You'll get a sense through time, not just through the words.
And that goes not just for money. That's everything.
It goes for everything. I think people show you who they are through the smallest gestures, not through the big over-the-top things. So really, actually, on a first date, I polled hundreds of women in New York, and I asked that question. Would you go out on a second date if the man didn't offer on the first? Now, don't shoot the messenger, I say to the, the listeners. But, you know, close to 100% of women, over 92% of women said, yeah, I would be totally turned off if he didn't offer to pay. That said, I think it's entitled if you always, you know, always expect someone to cover you. We're both adults here. But on a first date, that still says a lot to the dater.
Outside of behavior, when do you think it's, let's say, and everyone's different, advisable to really start with some of the nitty gritty stuff? Like, how much debt are you carrying? How is your credit? You know, what's going on?
Once you start talking about long-term stuff together, which inevitably comes up in a committed relationship if you're both on the same page. So once you start talking about where would you want to live, do you want kids, these questions do come up. That's exactly the time. And if you have debt, what are your plans? How are you going to pay that off separately, together? You have to put it on the table.
And so what do you think, you know, we know that money arguments and money stress can break up a lot of folks. Have you seen some, let's say, character elements of resilience in couples where, you know, what puts them on the same page or what keeps them going through these very difficult conversations?
I think it's communication, really. It's listening to each other and hearing what the other person needs and respecting that. So we know when communications break down, relationships break up. And money talk is part of that. So it's not that you have money. You know this more than anyone. It's not that you have money. It's how you are with money, how you respect each other around this topic. I've seen couples in which one has come in with significant debt and they're partners. They're partners through and through. And they've made plans together to pay it off, knowing that they each have to make sacrifices. That's true partnership.
I hear from a lot of women who, you know, we tend to be caretakers, right? So I hear from a lot of women who are dating somebody with bad credit. And so they're like, well, I'll take out the loan. I'll take care of this. I'll take care of that. What is your advice? Because I think that this comes from a place, I'm sure, of love. But there's got to be some boundaries.
There has to be boundaries. One of my big relationship tips is date the person, not the potential.
Ooh.
Date the person in front of you.
I'm making a t-shirt of that.
We can print up bumper stickers.
Yes.
You have to look at what the person is offering now, who he or she is now, and not who you believe. It's great to believe in someone, but we need those boundaries.
Andrea Sirtash is the host of the Life Story Project on OWN and the author of Cheat on Your Husband with Your Husband. Thank you so much, Andrea, for joining us.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. Are you screening dates based on credit? Or would you like to? Tell us your take at MarketplaceMoney.org. Record your comments by hitting on the green button. And be sure to tell us your name and location so we can have you on air soon. This is Marketplace Money from APM. So credit can be a potentially dangerous tool. For many, having access to credit can spell trouble, deep trouble. But where there's a will, there's a way. I want you to meet Candy. She and her husband paid off a total of $123,000 of credit card debt in 4.5 years. Candy joins us from Richmond, Wisconsin. Thank you so much for being with us, Candy.
You're welcome.
Candy, so tell us a little bit about how that hole happened.
What had happened is my husband and I, you know, wanted to start a family. And so I came home from a part-time job, you know, the substantial income that was reduced. We didn't accommodate in our spending. I was also soon thereafter expecting twins. And so when we gave birth to them, it was, you know, two of everything. And several years of basically just overspending a little bit every month and not adjusting our spending, you know, to the income. It was that easy.
So tell us how you started the climb out.
Well, the first step was really coming to the realization that we were in trouble. And as a wife, I'm a home educator, and I at that point was stay at home and watched the demeanor of my husband become increasingly depressed. And obviously, just to look at him was a man that was extremely burdened about something. Communicating one to another and realizing that we were in trouble, and coming together as a couple. Ironically, before I came home, I was actually a supervisor for a regional credit division of a major retailer. So I was familiar with the credit industry very much
right.
So. So I kind of knew where to reach out. And for us locally, that was through Family Means, which is a credit consumer counseling service, which is overseen by the National Foundation for Consumer Credit out of Washington, but this one is based in Stillwater, Minnesota. And I, with my background, I understood, you know, the importance of a good credit score. And we, to that point, we were on, you know, we were current with everything, but I knew it was a matter of time. And so we sought a debt management plan that would allow us the ability to pay everything back, you know, not a restructuring or something that would be, quote, really a partial bankruptcy.
Well, and to do that, your husband took on so many jobs and he was, you know, it was really extreme for you guys. I mean, he was sleeping in the car. You were, yes, you know, cooking these very austere meals, and your family helped a little bit, right?
Yes, they did. You know, Russ took, he did take on a second job, and he needed a part-time job because he's a full-time chemist during the day and it needed to be at night. So there weren't a lot of options. So the long and short of it is he basically was a janitor at a local grocery store where he mopped floors and scrubbed toilets for 4.5 years, 5 nights a week. And the days of the week that he did not have to work at that part-time job here in town, yeah, he would sleep overnight in our vehicle at his day job. And we're talking Minnesota winters here.
Oh,
so
wow.
It was cold, but he did that, especially as the fuel prices rose, because we would save $8 to $100 a month of gas expense in order to put food on the table.
If you had some advice for folks out there, because there's a lot of folks who are still in trouble, and, you know, how did you get the strength to really keep committed to this, even when things were just so incredibly hard?
You keep your eyes on the end goal, and that was getting back to zero for Russell and myself. And humanly speaking, we can do a lot of things if we know it's not forever. What I would advise folks is, you know, the program that we were a part of, which is a debt management plan or DMP, and these are important terms to know because it is mm-hmm. a full payback, you know, and the nonprofit organizations like the NFCC overseas, you know, they don't put strict qualification or they don't pre-qualify, well, are we going to help you or not? And a DMP, although your credit may suffer initially, we came out of this program actually about 7 or 8 months early. We were able to purchase a home at a fixed low interest rate before we made our final payment.
Great.
And the thing of it is, too, there were not user's fees. We have 11 credit cards. So, you know,
wow,
for them, logistically, it was a lot to take care of. And the debt management plan was beneficial in reducing our stress because now we only had to focus on one payment every month going out versus paying 11 different credit cards. They were able to negotiate lower fixed interest rates, which is also difficult for us as consumers to do.
Right.
And so these are things for people to realize. And, you know, when we went in there, I was like so thrilled that someone, A, told us that we could do it. And when we went into Family Means in Stillwater, the counselor, she was not condemnatory at all. She mm-hmm. looked at it and said, you can do this. It's going to be extremely yep. hard, but you can do it. Because pride enters in, people don't want to admit, you know, where they're at sometimes financially, especially regarding debt. But
right.
when we entered the program, the month that we first got on board, I took a look at all of our credit card statements, and on those 11 credit cards, we had $1,544 of newly assessed finance charges on those cards for 1 month.
Wow.
Anyway, I reassessed that after being with a debt management plan 4 months later, and those same 11 credit cards, the interest, their finance charge that was accrued was like $400 and some. So we saved
Huge.
Thousands of dollars
yeah.
just
thousands
by
of
going
dollars.
To someone that could direct us and mm-hmm. give us a plan to follow. So,
and you bring up a
huge.
Really good point, Candy, about shame and feeling bad. You know, for folks if they, to absolutely kind of get over that hump of feeling that way and just get the help, you know, you saved $1,000 a month and then you got a plan that you could actually stick to. Candy, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Oh, you're very, very welcome.
And if you're having trouble managing your debt, you can find a nonprofit credit counselor near you through the National Foundation for Credit Counseling at nfcc.org. Soon, we may be able to pay for groceries with a retinal scan, our biology linked to our credit. But there is still a big bad world out there that only takes cash. Wall Street Journal's Market Watch posted a story this week on where your credit cards are not welcome. For example, don't try to swipe your plastic to pay for your marijuana in Colorado, at least not yet. Or to donate to WikiLeaks, know that they don't accept American Express. And have you ever tried to pay college tuition, your mortgage, or buy lotto tickets with a credit card? Why not? For more on where your cards are not welcome and why, check out my post on MarketplaceMoney.org. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, how to make more money outside of your full-time job and possibly start a whole new career. And as always, I'll be answering your money questions. We're here for you. Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali, Dan Simatovich, Candice Manriquez, Raghu Manavalan, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Brendan Willard is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Namrin Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. Remember to always check with your financial pro before you make any big money decisions. Thanks for listening, and let's talk soon.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.